Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Taking to the streets, thousands of Chinese citizens protest the Communist Party's ongoing zero COVID policy in the largest demonstrations in decades. Then, extremism and politics. Former President Trump has dinner with a white supremacist at Mar-a-Lago, renewing questions for Republicans about the party's leadership and values. And vaccine skepticism. Misinformation about COVID-19 sets back efforts to immunize people in the Democratic Republic of Congo against a host of other diseases.
This threatens increased outbreaks, deaths, and for some who survived the illnesses that they otherwise wouldn't have gotten, lifelong consequences.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The largest protests since Tiananmen Square in 1989 are rocking China as tens of thousands of demonstrators across the country fill the streets this weekend to denounce Beijing's strict quarantine and testing policies known as zero COVID. But some of the demonstrations quickly evolved into demands for political change, including the removal of President Xi Jinping himself. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
In the southwestern city of Chengdu, protesters demand freedom. Freedom of press, they chant, freedom of speech. In the central city of Wuhan, where COVID began, they break down the fence that kept them quarantined. And in the western city of Urumqi, they fly the flag and demand the end of lockdowns. Nationwide protests. Lit by a literal fire in Urumqi last week. Witnesses say a COVID lockdown trapped residents in a burning building and killed at least 10. But this is a national release of pent-up anger. They're furious with zero COVID and its brutal enforcement, which continued this weekend on a BBC reporter in Shanghai. There, in China's largest city, the protests got personal.
Xi Jinping!
Step down Xi Jinping, they chant, one of the few times in years that demonstrators used his name. The protests spread to the capital, Beijing, including the Tsinghua University, one of the country's most famous campuses. Those who didn't want to make it explicit didn't have to. A blank piece of paper, or an equation by physicist Alexander Freeman, as in free man, which many protesters no longer are.
In Shanghai, a lot of people have already been detained. They did it for everybody, for all the people. Free those people in Shanghai.
In Washington today, National Security Spokesman John Kirby endorsed Chinese citizens' right to peaceful protest.
A lockdown is not a policy that we support here. But obviously there are people in China that have concerns about that, and they're protesting that, and we believe they should be able to do that peacefully.
Beijing maintains the world's strictest COVID controls. Hundreds of millions of people must submit to daily tests and quarantine for extended periods. Recently, China relaxed some rules and shortened quarantines for close contacts of COVID patients and for foreign visitors, eliminated contact tracing for secondary contacts, and phased out routine mass testing in several cities. Today, Beijing City announced it would further ease some quarantine rules and Guangzhou reduce mass testing. But today, Chinese authorities defended zero COVID and denied that national unrest threatened the policy.
China has been following the dynamic zero COVID policy and has been making adjustments. We believe that with the leadership of the Communist Party of China and cooperation from the Chinese people, our fight against COVID-19 will be successful.
And for more on the significance of these protests, we turn to longtime China watcher Min-Chin Pei, professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. Min-Chin Pei, thanks very much. Welcome back to the NewsHour. How significant do you think these protests are?
These are very significant protests in three respects. First, for the first time, we've seen simultaneous protests in major Chinese cities. The other thing about this round of protests is that participants seem to come from a wide range of social backgrounds, and that has not happened in the last 30 years. And third, and most importantly, some of the demands are explicitly political. We've not heard ordinary people chanting Xi Jinping and the Communist Party to step down. So all these three things make these protests very, very significant.
Because we should note that it's not that protest is unprecedented in China. It is just that most protests we've seen for the last 30 years, and certainly since Xi Jinping took power, have been localized, have been local groups objecting to local policies.
Absolutely. Ordinary protests typically have local issues, socioeconomic issues, and they never spill beyond the boundaries of a county or a small town. But this time, it's very, very different.
We've seen Beijing in recent days take baby steps to ease some of its zero COVID policies. But the message from Xi Jinping himself, elevating people who have enacted the strictest forms of zero COVID, could that message be changed or adjusted at all because of these protests?
I think these protests will force the government, and in particular President Xi Jinping, to adjust his policy, because the message from the protesters is also quite clear. The current situation is not tolerable, and they want the government to change its course.
A Chinese official told me that he feared that if China opened up, more than a million people would die. Isn't that fear legitimate, since China's vaccines have been proven to be less effective than Western mRNA vaccines, which are still not allowed in the country?
The honest answer is that nobody knows. Of course, if they open up, there will be a surge in case infections, and also there will likely be a surge of hospitalization, and obviously there will be an increase in the number of deaths. Now you have to sort of balance that against now what appears to be a nationwide demand for the government to change its course. But if I have to guess, I think I'm leaning toward a gradual relaxation rather than doubling down on the policy that seems to be delivering nothing but misery.
Is there any evidence that anyone around Xi Jinping, anyone who has power or influence over him, object to this policy that has been so closely associated with him personally?
No, not at that level. I think at the very top level, President Xi has a group of colleagues that he personally trusts, and those colleagues will back his policy no matter what. I think what the Chinese leadership probably worries a lot more about is local officials, because local officials are on the front line of enforcing zero COVID. And these people are human beings too. So they are tired, they're frustrated, and probably they would like to have a course correction as well.
And zero COVID hasn't only caused social protests, it's depressed growth. China's growing at the second slowest rate in 46 years. What does it say about Xi Jinping that he appears to be prioritizing zero COVID over economic growth?
Well, I think at some point he has to balance zero COVID with economic losses. So if you do a back of the envelope calculation, China has lost about 2% of GDP in terms of growth, and that comes down to about at least $350 billion. So that's a very big number, and that affects employment, that affects government expenditures.
But he has made the decision toward loyalty and toward control over growth in the past, hasn't he?
Oh, yes. But I think when he made those decisions, the economic costs were not that obvious. Today, the costs are undeniable, and these costs are mounting. So as China's leader, now it's his third term, he will not look at what is happening now. He has to look at what is going to happen in the next 5 years. So making a cost shift might be the smartest thing to do than sticking with a very costly policy.
Min Chunpei, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In the day's other news, the unrest in China sent a shudder down Wall Street. Major stock indexes dropped 1.5% over fears of any global economic fallout. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 500 points to finish at 33,849. The NASDAQ fell close to 177 points. The S&P 500 slid 62. A white teenager pleaded guilty today to fatally shooting 10 black shoppers and workers at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. Peyton Gendron, who is 19, posted racist rants before the attack last May. After today's hearing, a son of one victim said the real problem is white supremacy.
This has not happened chance. This was all planned. This was intentional. I heard a lot about justice today. There is no justice unless we deal with that. Mm. There is no justice unless we deal with what facilitated this murder, these murders.
Gendron's plea on state charges means mandatory life in prison without parole. He could still face the death penalty on federal hate crimes charges. In Ukraine, officials are warning of another hard week with more Russian missile strikes against power and water systems. Kyiv's mayor says that some of the city's 3 million people might have to be evacuated. Meanwhile, Baltic and Nordic nations are pledging electric generators, warm clothes, and food to help Ukrainians cope. Iran today rejected a UN investigation of its crackdown on protests. That came as activists reported 450 protesters have died in 2 months of unrest, with more than 18,000 arrested. They include the niece of Ayatollah Khomeini, Iran's supreme leader. In a video made before her arrest, she urged the world to cut ties with Tehran.
Oh, free people, be with us. And tell your governments to stop supporting this murderous and child-killing regime. This regime is not loyal to any of its religious principles.
The protest began after a young Kurdish woman died in police custody in Tehran back in September. Six European countries have taken down a so-called super cartel that controlled a third of the continent's cocaine trade. The operation resulted in dozens of arrests over 2 years. Spanish authorities today released video of the raids. They included seizing more than 30 tons of drugs and huge collections of luxury goods. Back in this country, more than 2 million people in Houston spent the day under boil water notice after a power outage at a water purification plant. The city's mayor said that testing will determine when the water is safe again.
I will say stuff does happen. It's unfortunate. A lot of people were impacted and are impacted. Certainly apologize for that. But we'll do a diagnostic review and work with all of our partners to assess the situation and to mitigate a future occurrence of this kind.
For now, Houston residents must boil water for cooking, bathing, and drinking. Schools are closed as well. This was a deadline day in Arizona for certifying the midterm election results, and at least one Republican-controlled county refused to do so. Vote counts have shown that Democrats are winning the state's major races. The GOP candidates for governor and secretary of state have refused to concede. And the world's largest volcano, Mauna Loa in Hawaii, is erupting for the first time in nearly 40 years. It started late Sunday. The night sky around the summit glowed as ominous red as lava and volcanic ash spewed out, posing a risk to several subdivisions. For now, the lava is contained, but the ash is disrupting flights into Hilo. Still to come on the NewsHour, Tamara Keith and Amy Walter look ahead to the lame duck session in Congress. Misinformation about COVID-19 sets back efforts to immunize children in the Democratic Republic of Congo, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
1 week after former President Donald Trump announced that he would seek re-election to the nation's top office, he dined at his Mar-a-Lago home with two men known for their racist and anti-Semitic beliefs, 24-year-old political commentator Nick Fuentes and Ye, the hip-hop musician formerly known as Kanye West. Laura Barone-Lopez has more.
The Department of Justice identified Fuentes as a white supremacist last year. He is a Holocaust denier who has threatened violence against Jewish people and spread hate against Black Americans and other groups. Ye has also been condemned for anti-Semitic and anti-Black comments. In statements, Trump claimed Fuentes was invited by Ye and that he did not know him. The dinner is the most recent example, however, of the former president associating with bigoted individuals and conspiracy theorists and elevating their ideas. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer responded on the floor today.
For a former president to sit down and have dinner with a high-profile anti-Semite is disgusting and dangerous. To give an anti-Semite even the smallest platform, much less an audience over dinner, is pure evil. Even assuming the former president didn't realize Mr. Fuentes was coming to Mar-a-Lago, for him to refuse to condemn Fuentes and his bigoted words after the dinner is appalling and it is dangerous.
We asked every Republican senator and every member of Republican House leadership today whether they thought the meeting was appropriate and if they condemned it. Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy said, Trump hosting racist anti-Semites for dinner encourages other racist anti-Semites. And Maine Senator Susan Collins told NewsHour, the president should never have had a meal or even a meeting with Nick Fuentes. The vast majority of them did not respond to us. For more on what this means for the Republican Party, I'm joined by Mary McCord. She is the director of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection and a former Justice Department official. And Stuart Stevens. He is a former Republican consultant, now at the Lincoln Project, and a new pro-democracy media platform, Resolute Square. Thank you both for joining NewsHour today. Stu, I want to start with you. As Republican senators were returning to Washington this evening, they were asked by reporters about the dinner, and a number of them said that it was, quote, inappropriate, that it was wrong, that there's no place for white supremacy in the Republican Party. Separately, former Vice President Mike Pence said that Trump should apologize for the meeting. What's your assessment of the Republican response so far?
Well, look, I think this has to be taken in context of what has happened to the Republican Party, which in my view is a complete moral collapse, unlike any we've really seen in America with a major political party. This happened in Florida. The governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, as far as I know, has yet to assert that Joe Biden won a legal and fair election. We talk about election deniers, but we focus on those who are out there campaigning on it. But the vast majority of elected Republican officials are yet to say that Donald Trump lost a free and fair election, which is how extreme can that be? That means that we don't live in a democracy. That means that they're participating as elected officials in something that is not a democracy. So this sort of extremist conspiracy theories have been allowed to grow in the Republican Party because it's lost touch with any governing philosophy. No one can articulate a realistic center-right governing philosophy with any credibility.
Mary, on Nick Fuentes specifically, what should our viewers understand about him and his role in Republican politics?
So he is a white supremacist who really kind of rose to some prominence after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, where he was present. He's been most recently very active in organizing Stop the Steal demonstrations back in 2020 and 2021. And he is someone who advocates great replacement theory. He's someone who really, though, tries, I think, to have a political influence, an influence on the Republican Party. And he's done this by creating his own organization, America First, his own PAC, the America First Political Action Committee, which essentially competes with CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee, to pull candidates and politicians even further to the fringe. I shouldn't say even, but just to the fringe, further to the fringe. And this is something that is really dangerous right now because it generates more and more publicity for himself. It generates more and more profit for himself, but it makes too many of our politicians right now feel like they need to pander to him, that they have something to lose if they're not able to pander to him and to his base. And I think that's exactly what we saw with the former president having dinner with Nick Fuentes. I don't personally believe that he didn't know who Nick Fuentes was. Nick Fuentes has his own PAC that supported President Trump. He was a major proponent of the Stop the Steal rallies. It just defies logic that the former president would not know who he is.
And Fuentes, as you noted, Mary, isn't new on the scene. Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Paul Gosar of Arizona spoke at Fuentes' white nationalist conference earlier this year, and yet there was no vast Republican condemnation of it across the party. Stu, what roots do you see of this? Why do you think that these figures are accepted within the Republican Party?
Well, I think the Republican Party has sadly accepted its role as a white grievance party. I mean, this goes back to really the history of the post-World War II Republican Party. There were really two strands. There was an Eisenhower strand, which was boring, governing, sane, and then a Joe McCarthy strand, which was xenophobic, conspiratorial, often racist. And these two have battled each other. And a lot of us who particularly were involved in George Bush's campaign with Passionate Conservative, we assumed that we were the dominant gene in the party and that we knew this dark side, but we thought that it would go away if only for the necessity of adopting to a changing America. But I don't know any conclusion to come to, but that we were wrong. And the other was the dominant gene. And this party has a history of this. Right now, there's a great nostalgia, call it, for William Buckley as an intellectual voice of the party. But we forget William Buckley started out as a stone cold segregationist. He later recanted, and I think genuinely so. But these are the roots of the Republican Party. 85% of Trump's vote was white in a country that is somewhere between 57 and 60% white. And that pretty much says it all.
Mary, when voices like Fuentes and Ye, who has said that slavery was a choice, get a meeting with the former president and they're associated with other GOP figures, what signal does that send not just to Fuentes' followers, but also to Republican voters?
Well, I think what the former president and so many other politicians who will associate openly with white supremacists and anti-Semites, I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to walk this fine line. They're trying to appeal to the base who is really motivated and turned on by this type of racist content, anti-Semitic content, embracing great replacement theory, you know, putting aside and undermining all semblance of democratic processes in America. They want to continue to appeal to that base, but then they want to have this plausible deniability of, oh, I didn't know who he was. Oh, I didn't understand what his philosophy was. Oh, he just came as a guest of Kanye West. They want to be able to say that in order to not completely abandon, you know, those who are less on the fringe of their party. Well, you know, they just can't have their cake and eat it, too. These things are not debatable. They should not be debatable in politics. There was a time, you know, not that long ago, where this would have been just condemned in the strongest possible terms across the party. And we're not seeing that right now. And so the message it sends, you know, it's dangerous. It is making it acceptable to not only hold these views, which of course is protected to hold these views by our Constitution, but to espouse those and to try to influence policy with types of theories and ideologies that are extremist, that are polarizing, and that are violent.
Mary McCord, Stuart Stevens, thank you so much for your time.
Lawmakers are back in the nation's capital after the holiday weekend and have a long list of issues they need to tackle before the end of the year, which includes key votes on new party leadership and as well as top priorities like funding the government. To dive into the politics of all of this, I am joined by our Politics Monday duo, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. And it is so good to see both of you on this Monday. Welcome. But I do want to start, frankly, with the conversation we just heard between Laura and our two guests, Tam. You heard what they are saying, that Republicans who are not denouncing former President Trump are trying to appeal to the base. What does this get them politically?
Well, and I will say that as members of Congress have returned to Capitol Hill, in particular senators, they're all being asked about it. And many of them are saying, well, I wouldn't have had dinner with those people, or Trump shouldn't have had dinner with those people. But Trump himself has not disavowed the dinner, has not disavowed his guests. Saying you didn't know somebody is different than saying, oh, my gosh, I can't believe I had dinner with an anti-Semite. I'm so sorry. That shouldn't have happened. And in fact, he hasn't disavowed the ideology of the people who came to dinner at his resort and had a private dinner with him. And part of the reason for that is that they support him, and they support some of these conspiracy theories that he has been promoting. Increasingly, he has been forwarding on memes that that appeal to the QAnon conspiracy theory, global conspiracy theory. And at the root of that conspiracy theory is a whole lot of anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Amy, what does this get the Republicans who are not denouncing former President Trump?
The big question is when, not so much when will Republican Party leaders come right out and say, stop it, no more, we are going to have no more of this with Donald Trump. When will Republican Party voters say that? And right now, if you look at the data, if you look at the polling, you still have a majority of Republicans out there saying they would support Donald Trump for a 2024 bid. Yes, there's a growing group of voters saying they're looking for somebody else or they'd like to support somebody else. Mm-hmm. But the only way that this goes, the message gets to Republicans in Congress, Republican leaders, is if their voters are saying, I don't want to support this person anymore.
And is there any evidence that that might happen
right
based
now,
on past
there's no,
history?
Based on past history? Well, again, you would think, given all the hand-wringing after this past election, there would be more frustration bubbling up among the sort of rank and file. We're seeing reports, some stories from state parties where internally, the state party chairs and others who were big Trump supporters are getting serious challenges. But it's much less about the belief system and the ideology of Donald Trump or who he's having dinner with, consorting with, than the fact that Donald Trump is no longer the winner that he was in 2016.
And I will say that as I was talking to voters right before the midterms, there were a lot of them who expressed reservations about Trump's baggage. They also expressed reservations about his losing. And he hadn't even lost the midterms yet with some of his candidates losing. So there is an unease, but you know what? Like, in 2015, I talked to a lot of voters who said, oh gosh, I wish he wouldn't tweet so much. I mean, now it's, well, I wish he wouldn't put so many things on Truth Social and hang out with conspiracy theorists. Yeah. It's not clear yet, and we won't know it until we see it,
right. Exactly.
Whether this is just too much baggage. Yeah.
Well, it's important to point it out and to talk about it, and then, you know, people can decide. Amy, Congress. It's back. At least some of it's back.
Yes.
Some of it's back. They've got a packed agenda. They've only got a few weeks to go, or less than that even, to get a lot of work done. I mean, keeping the government funded. How much of this are they likely to get done?
So there's a theory in lame duck legislating, which is the time we're in right now, that it's either a time to get all of your wish list, all the things you couldn't get done during the normal time. It's kind of like being a student and you crunched everything into that last week of school, trying to get it done, yeah. But in this case, we know that not only is there very little time, but there's not the coordinated support for some of the pieces of legislation that, say, Democrats would like to put forward, like finally dealing with immigration and DACA, or an assault weapons ban. That's not going to really go anywhere. The one thing that does seem to have bipartisan support, besides keeping the government open and the defense authorization legislation, is a gay marriage, basically repealing the Defense of Marriage Act from 1996 and ensuring federal protection for same-sex marriage across the country. That's probably, when I talk to folks today who watch this, that was their sense of the one thing that is most likely to make it through.
And what about?
It's also possible that the Electoral Count Act could make it through, because there is bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. They need to reconcile those measures. If it's going to happen, it's going to have to happen in the lame duck, because what happens when Republicans take over the House is all of these measures that are passing on a bipartisan basis with like a few Republicans and a lot of Democrats. Democrats control the floor right now. If they don't control the floor, if Republicans control the floor, it doesn't matter that like 10 Republicans support a bill. They're not going to bring it to the floor. That's a fast track to losing your speakership.
So a lot of change. Speaking of the new Congress, I mean, we're already all thinking about this, Amy, the idea that it's Democrats are turning it over a new generation.
That's right. On Wednesday, for the first time in 20 years, Democrats will have a new leader of their party, most likely to be Hakeem Jeffries. No one's challenging him. He would be the first black leader of any party for the House or the Senate. Interestingly, you know, I was looking through this today before I came in, because that's the kind of dork that I am, that when Nancy Pelosi was elected to leadership in 2001, Democrats had essentially the same number of seats in Congress. 214, they have 213 now. But the makeup of Congress was so different. They had members from Arkansas and North Dakota and Mississippi. Now, the caucus is more diverse. Mm-hmm. There are more women, there are more people of color, but ideologically, geographically, much less diverse than it was when Pelosi took over. So in some ways, Jeffries' job is challenging in that he's got a very diverse caucus, he's got to keep them together, progressives, moderates, but they kind of all come from the same place, which is very different than trying to get people who are from New York City and southern Mississippi on the same page.
The moderates have just kind of...
That's right.
Sunk into the background.
There are very few of them. Right.
Very few of them. New Congress, it's a change among the Democrats, and for the Republicans, they've got a lot of figuring out to do.
Right, and they have this very narrow majority. They also have more than a dozen, close to 20 Republicans who won in Biden districts or blue or purple districts. And so these are Republicans who may not be quite so excited about passing a partisan messaging bill or launching, you know, approving a subpoena for a White House official or doing some of these more showy things that other Republicans, more hardcore Republicans, that many of the Republicans in leadership ran on. And so it will be an interesting balance seeing whether these moderates just have to go along or whether they end up causing problems for their leadership that are different problems than the leadership is worried about right now, which is their more conservative members, you know, trying to extract concessions from leadership before Kevin McCarthy or whoever it ends up being is ultimately elected speaker.
So is all this a recipe for
It's going to be quite interesting. Well, we have a big generational change on the Democratic side, too. It's really important to point that out, especially Jeffries
Pelosi
is in his early 50s. Pelosi, of course, is 80. And other members of the Democratic leadership also much younger than the current members of leadership. The thing that is going to be the most interesting, besides what Tam pointed out, is this rift between the Freedom Caucus, more conservative Trump, and the more moderate or traditional conservatives, is what happens with the debt ceiling, right?
Yes.
And that is one where very few votes, you've got to get the Senate. McConnell also has to get his team on board. And there are a lot more Trumpy senators in the Senate now than there were a couple years ago.
It's going to be so exciting.
A lot happening.
It's going to be a lot's at stake.
Yes.
A lot
at
stake in
Absolutely.
All this. Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, thank you both.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Millions of children around the world did not get routine vaccines as a result of disruptions and disinformation caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. That is the largest sustained decline in childhood immunizations in a generation, according to the United Nations. In some countries, as in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, these setbacks threaten to undo years of public health advances. Special correspondent Benedict Moran and video journalist Jorgen Samso report.
In this health center on the outskirts of Kinshasa, community health workers are preparing to administer a round of routine vaccinations. In Africa alone, every year, more than 800,000 lives are saved because of routine vaccines, according to the World Health Organization. Though a painful part of growing up, vaccines are one of the most successful public health interventions. It is the safest way to protect children from life-threatening diseases like polio, measles, rubella, and tetanus. But over the last 2 years, vaccination rates are plummeting, not just here, but across the planet, and doctors are worried. For the first time in a generation, last year, more than 25 million children missed out on basic vaccines. Health workers fear that without focusing greater efforts on increasing the rate of childhood vaccination, many diseases that were once under control may return. In July, the UN's World Health Organization sounded the alarm.
This is the largest sustained decline in childhood vaccination in approximately 30 years. This threatens increased outbreaks, deaths, and for some who survived the illnesses that they otherwise wouldn't have gotten, lifelong consequences.
One major reason for the decline? The global shutdowns associated with COVID-19 put a strain on public health systems. In the DRC, which is the size of one quarter of the continental US, getting services to far-flung parts of the country is not easy.
We are on our way to Lukunga, an island in the middle of the Congo River between Congo Kinshasa and Congo Brazzaville, the neighboring country. Villages here are extremely remote, and it's very difficult for vaccine teams to reach them.
Prior to April this year, the area had no permanent health center. Under COVID lockdowns, it became even more isolated.
We have difficulty reaching this area because it is very far. The distance is 34 miles, and you have to cross the river to reach here.
Lukunga Island is a small community of farmers. There are no roads and no electricity. With health systems now trying to return to a post-COVID normal, it's a game of catch-up. That means walking from house to house, calling loudly for everyone to gather at this makeshift clinic under a cluster of bamboo.
These vaccines are for kids between 0 and 11 months. They are to protect them against polio and other viruses.
These parents require no convincing. Month by month and vaccine by vaccine, health workers hope to bring immunization rates here in these isolated areas back to normal. But elsewhere in the Congo, getting back to normal requires rebuilding trust. Vaccine misinformation, especially on social media, is perhaps the most influential reason why overall vaccination rates are going down. Less than 5% of the country is vaccinated against COVID-19.
Donner à tous le même vaccin, c'est une hérésie intellectuelle.
Videos like this one, often originating from outside Africa, spread lies that COVID-19 vaccines cause infertility or even death. That makes some Congolese resistant, not only against the COVID-19 vaccine, but increasingly against other routine vaccines as well.
La pandémie a affecté notre système de vaccination.
The pandemic has affected our vaccination system and created reluctance among the population regarding all vaccination. The information comes from social media. In some communities, they could not distinguish what is true and what is not.
COVID vaccine centers like this one in the center of Kinshasa vaccinate only a few hundred people every day. That's a trickle for a city of more than 17 million people. 28-year-old Acha Christel was one of the few in line. He says he had to overcome his own fears before coming here.
I said, what is the vaccine for if it kills me? Why take it? It really discouraged me. But I said to myself, no, I won't be discouraged. I have to take the vaccine.
That's why education is key and restoring trust, not just in the COVID-19 vaccine, but in all routine vaccinations, starts here at Kinshasa's central vaccine warehouse.
This vaccine storage facility on the outskirts of Kinshasa is one of the largest in Africa, but it's not just a warehouse. It also serves as a center of education. Community leaders are often brought here to learn about vaccines and the influence of disinformation.
DRC is home to huge revivalist Christian ministries, and those churches are sometimes hotspots of vaccine hesitancy. As part of a UN Children's Fund and Ministry of Health campaign, the leaders from many of these parishes in Kinshasa get a VIP behind-the-scenes tour and see for themselves the high-tech infrastructure required to refrigerate and store the country's stock of vaccines. They then spread the word, vaccines save lives.
Pastors need to care not just about the spiritual health of their community, but also about the general well-being of their community. And for kids, with regards to vaccines, they need to find an environment that is favorable to their well-being.
Back at the Community Health Center, health workers know that focusing on education is an approach that works. Today, vaccine rates here are high, but that wasn't always the case.
As there were rumors everywhere on social media, people were scared. Even the women weren't coming here. Now, with sensitization, the community has approached us. Now everyone has access to vaccinations. And the children? Even the COVID vaccine? People tend to come asking for it, even if it's not in stock.
It's a small success story that health workers hope can apply to the rest of this vast and sprawling country. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Benedict Moran in Kinshasa, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
And we'll be back shortly with a look at how a museum uses technology to deepen visitor engagement with ancient art. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like ours on the air. For those stations staying with us, a Netflix series has gained acclaim for its portrayal of Arab American life rarely presented in popular culture, and for the comedian who wrote and stars in the show. Here's another look at Jeffrey Brown's conversation with Mo Ammer, who bases this story on his own.
I went in there for some legal advice.
Did you hear the one about the Muslim immigrant of Palestinian descent, his Mexican-born girlfriend, and Nigerian-American best friend? Welcome to the world of Mo.
I don't believe in therapy. It's a scam.
How's therapy a scam?
Because you pay some PhD $200 an hour where you can talk to God for free anytime.
I don't ever see you get out of prayer mat.
Yeah, I don't walk around with a prayer rug all the time. What am I, Aladdin? This is not Disney.
The Houston-centered life of Mo Ammer and the character he plays in the series Mo is an American mashup of cultural collision, comedy, and crisis.
Amen, el padre, el hijo, el espíritu santo.
No, don't do that.
Some things are sacred, like the olive oil he carries in a small bottle at all times, reminding him of his homeland. And don't even think of trying to sell him chocolate hummus.
There, nobody knows where it comes from. Nobody even knows what hummus means. Hummus means chickpeas. Like, people walk up to me like, here's some red bean hummus. This is not hummus, okay? This is red bean mash. That's what this is. We made it! We made it, y'all!
Two Netflix comedy specials first raised his profile nationally. Here, he riffs off the pandemic and more.
We're here. That was the second time I ever thought my career potentially might be over. The first time... was right after 9/11. Someone named Muhammad, I was like, it's not looking good for me out here.
And now Mo, the series, goes further, pushing Ammer into acting. And a sensitive, funny, but often painful portrayal of a family very much like his own. Parents who left Palestine and migrated to Kuwait, where Mo himself was born. And then in the Gulf War, fled again, this time for the Houston suburb of Alief, entering the U.S. as refugees.
I mean, I pinch myself daily.
On a visit to New York recently, he spoke of recent success, but early professional pressure to steer clear of his personal story.
My friends, my really good friends in stand-up and comedy, would just be like, oh, my God. I'd work with them. They'd come in from L.A. and they'd do shows in Houston. And a couple of occasions, was like, just change your name, you know, just...
Change your name.
Change your name. Just, you're so talented. Just change your name. Like, it'll be so much easier. Like, you're just so good. Like, they would just tell me this. It would hurt my heart. I'm like, what do you mean? You want me to just pretend to be something else? That's the essence of stand-up. You're talking about acting at that point. Like, you want me to act in my real life? And how long do I hold on this charade for? Like, that's definitely not it.
Mo, the series, takes it on directly. There's plenty of humor, but Mo and his family are barely scraping by financially.
Shalom.
He finds work on an olive tree farm. As in real life, his father, a telecom engineer, died young of a heart attack, and Mo learns he'd been tortured earlier in his life. 20 years in, the family is still waiting for citizenship papers, a painful bureaucratic process. It's a portrait of a fragile, in-between existence.
Very similar to my life, where it took me 20 years to get my citizenship. You felt like you were American. I felt like I was. And then somebody would tell you, like, oh, wait, you weren't born here? And then they feel a little different. And we're like, well, how can you pay taxes and still not have your papers? I'm like, yeah, it's complicated. And that's been my whole life.
When you thought about what story you wanted to tell in this series, how important is that Palestinian identity, that heritage?
Well, it's important to me because it's who I am, right? I am Palestinian. Where I come from, these people do exist. And so it was important to me to just highlight that. But it wasn't the main point. It was just happens to be like the vehicle to deliver all these like messages of belonging. If you ever worked, you know, paycheck to paycheck, trying to take care of your family, unable to do it. You don't have to be an immigrant to relate to the story. You just happen to be connecting with a Palestinian family while you're doing so.
Was it always obvious to you that you could use comedy as a way in to look at very serious issues that this series takes on?
It's a great question. So deeply personal to me. It's like, I don't know if I could share that. Like, that's a lot. Like, how do you share that on camera? Are you comfortable with this? Imagine doing that, like, and then it's just on Netflix. It's gonna go out to every country on planet Earth that has a subscription will be able to see it. That's a really hard thing to do and very challenging emotionally. However, it's really important to settle into that, to sit in it, to breathe in it, to feel it.
I'm so sick and tired of having to work.
A serious moment, his mother pushing back against his despair.
Hey, why you are raising your voice on us? What do you want us to do, huh? Sit and cry? Do you think me and your dad sat out there feeling sorry for ourselves because Saddam took everything we had?
All the things that had to happen for me to come here and to do a series, to end up with a series. It's like we were born, my mom fled Palestine and ended up in Kuwait. From Kuwait, you were born and then you had to flee war. This little kid, this 9-year-old kid ends up in Houston, Texas. He goes to the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, sees stand-up for the first time. That's what I'm supposed to do. 4 years later, my dad passes away. I'm doing stand-up in English class, so my teacher's way of getting me to not skip anymore and to try to help bring me back. So I think it feels very much like destiny.
So how surprised are you to be able to, you know, head a comedy show?
I'm not gonna lie, I look around sometimes like, is it real? Like, this is great. Like, it's really being received so well, and I think that it's clear that the appetite is really big for some real stories that connect with people in a big way. And I'm just so grateful. The hard work really pays off, you know, really does pay off.
Mo, hi!
Mo Hammer is now waiting to hear if Mo, the series, will be renewed for a second season. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in New York.
Ancient sculptures at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts are getting a new look after years of reimagining how to present the great Greek, Roman, and Byzantine art. The museum has found ways to draw threads from thousands of years ago to today. Special correspondent Jared Bowen of GBH Boston reports for our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
This is a moment to experience the divine.
It is in the philosophy of the Greeks to aspire to be like the gods. These are idealized. The hero Heracles, perfectly muscular. Aphrodite, perfectly sensual in all the right places.
The gods and goddesses are within reach here at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, which has just unveiled a series of reimagined galleries featuring the work of ancient Greece, Rome, and the Byzantine Empire. They take visitors back thousands of years, scaling the heights of a veritable Mount Olympus, and dipping into the bustle of daily life.
We are listening in on conversations of folks that lived 3,000 years ago, who drank good wine, who had parties in which they sang odes to the heroes, told stories about the gods, and had philosophical discussions that resulted in democracy, major drama that we still perform.
Christine Kondolian is chair of the museum's Greek and Roman collections. She says in this gallery of the gods, these statues represent their stand-ins, often sculpted for worship in temples. Zeus might still be the front and center king, but it's the flanking gods who got down to business.
You could pray to them. If you were sick, you would go to a place like Epidaurus and seek help from Asclepius, the god of medicine. Hygieia, who is the goddess of health. We really need her in the world today. You could invoke help from them, and you could honor them. Because if you didn't honor them, they might hurt you. So this was part of the deal.
A formidable thought when it comes to the 13-foot-tall, 13,000-pound Juno, married to Jupiter or Zeus. The largest classical sculpture in America, she descended from the sky into the museum 10 years ago after standing anonymously in a suburban Boston estate for more than a century.
My research has tracked her back to the late 1st century BC, standing in the Theater of Pompey, the first marble theater of Rome.
These galleries meander from the monumental to the matters of every day, to fashionable hair, tools, and drinking cups, to commemorations of creativity and carousing.
What really touches me, it's the human connection. It's this thread that, you know, ties you to this person 2,000 years ago that, you know, touched the object.
Laura Marest is one of the gallery's curators. She says some of what we find here carries the same urgency it did thousands of years ago, like a seemingly simplistic triangle. It carries a much deeper meaning.
It's shaped like female genitalia. And on the top, there is an inscription. The inscription clearly says it's a gift given by a woman named Daphne as a thank you to Zeus Hephaestus for having healed her. And, you know, those are things that we still experience. And when you might not have the modern medicine we have today, you have to turn to something, someone, maybe a greater someone, to try to help.
Meet Antiochides, a highly regarded master potter.
Marest was also instrumental in bringing technology into the galleries.
In the 6th century BCE, Athenian vases were prized far and wide for their superior shapes and designs.
This film describes a fictional story about the very real and revolutionary practices at play in creating this Athenian vase from the 6th century BC, when artisans discovered a way to depict figures in red and not the usual black.
It's not only a history of aesthetics, it's also a history of technology, because really this requires huge experiment in firing, in basically chemistry. They probably had to do thousands of experiments to come up with this really complicated system.
Back in the Gods and Goddesses Gallery, a Roman replica of a statue at the Acropolis is a digital revelation all its own.
For a long time, I think we've all looked at ancient statues and thought, well, this is how they were created. Is this how they were created?
It's not. Originally, it was very brightly painted. It's almost garish sometimes, we think today. And so we decided that really part of our mandate here was to convey this, because we need to show how the ancients encountered those works.
To determine how the statue originally looked, the museum employed a host of methods from old school scrutiny.
If you look really closely, for example, here,
I do see those, yeah.
You see the reddish hues? So Our Lady Athena had red hair.
To special lighting, photographic techniques, and chemical analysis.
What especially reacted is it's a blue pigment called Egyptian blue that reacts under specific light conditions. And we did find a lot of it on the aegis, on her helmet.
It all means we may need to credit the Greeks and Romans with giving us Technicolor, too. For the PBS NewsHour in Boston, I'm Jared Bowen.
And we are glad to do that. Thank you, Jared. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.